Hello all and welcome back to another episode of Life of Brian.
Your name is?
Harrison.
My name is?
Brian, I assume. Yep. BT, Barge, Bristle.
Back from Gather Round, which was absolutely sensational. And I hear people trying to destroy it already. I hear people saying, oh, why don't we have a Gather Round in Sydney and Gold Coast and Perth? And I'm thinking the more this goes on, the more it's suited to Adelaide. Perth, too expensive. Sydney, they don't give a shit. You wouldn't own any of the city. You've got to own the city. That's why it works in Adelaide, because everyone in Adelaide is on board with it. Everyone. The whole city welcomes the footy world, right? That wouldn't happen in Sydney. Wouldn't happen in Brisbane. It would happen in Perth, but it's just too expensive to get to. Perth's the only other city in the world, maybe Hobart, Tasmania as well, that you could actually do it.
That's a good one. Hobart could be.
Hobart's possible. Grounds are an issue at the moment until they get the new one built. But, Gather Round was absolutely sensational. Peter Malinauskas, the Premier over there, has done an outstanding job. He's improved it by 30% from year one to year two. And I was speaking with him, not dropping names, but I was speaking with him the other day when I had lunch with him, and he said next year they'll improve it by another 30%.
Atmosphere was unreal. Complete buy-in from the Adelaideans.
Amazing. We were walking up in bloody Harndorf. You and I and the family went up to Harndorf for 3 or 4 hours in the morning. It was like walking down Swanson Street at lunchtime. It was unbelievable. In fact, something unusual happened to you.
Yeah, well,
I saw it out the corner of my eye.
For the first time ever, I was stopped in the street.
For a photo.
For a photo.
On the basis of this Life of Brian podcast.
Yes, I had Choco and Ollie from Swan Hill stop me in the street and we chatted for about 10 minutes and I was just reveling in the fact that someone recognized me.
And you've got.
And you hate it.
And you've been carried away ever since.
Yes,
get on with it. What are we talking about?
So we are proudly brought to you by Lawson Country Estate.
Lawson Lodge, yeah.
Yep, Lawson Lodge. So they're nestled in the picturesque Macedon Ranges. Lawson Lodge Country Estate is an unforgettable private retreat surrounded by lush gardens, a private golf course, and stunning scenery. Lawson Lodge is the perfect escape for those seeking both nature and nurture. You can indulge in an ultimate getaway and experience the magic of Lawson Lodge.
This place is a ripper. I've been up there and played golf. I've seen weddings up there. It's a great, idyllic wedding location. There's no doubt about
65
that.
65-acre property. It's got a private golf course, 9 holes.
Yeah, this was done by this is owned by a family, done by a family. 40 minutes from Melbourne. Great accommodation up there as well. Got an incredible bar. You go up there. The guy that owns it is actually a Western Bulldogs man. He's got a lot of Western Bulldogs jumpers. It's got a what do you call it? Where you have a room and you sit 300 people in the room and
like a
conference area. Yep. It can either be conference or for weddings. The bar and that is sensational. The golf course is sensational. The views are unbelievable. It's at the foothill of Mount Macedon, basically. Beautiful area. And this is a place where you want to go.
If you're interested in an event, whether it be a private retreat, a conference, business, corporate, a wedding, you can get in touch with Lawson Lodge. So speak to Chrissy there and make sure you mention that Life of Brian sent you.
Yep, absolutely. Lawson Lodge Country Estate, look
Beautiful.
It up.
Moving on. So we spoke about Gather Round. I also wanted to do Brian's Content Corner. We haven't done that in a few weeks.
Ooh, Full Swing. I've been watching Full Swing.
That's on Netflix. That's the golf.
Golf, because I wanted to be ready for the Masters.
So you had to get to know
the personalities. Watching for that. I am a little bit, from watching Full Swing and the whole Live versus PGA Tour thing with the Masters, and it appears that I was having a look at a John Ram interview who recently defected to Live for $300 million or something, saying that what he said was not good. He said he thinks talks have stalled between Live and the PGA. So I was hoping that these two groups would get together and we'd have a super-duper tour, you know, as a result of that, and everyone would benefit rather than the Live guys. Because I love Live. And I love the Adelaide event. It's absolutely sensational. But guys playing in shorts on resort courses,
not into it.
I'd just like them to all be together so I can clearly judge who is the best player in the world.
Yeah, but they're certainly mixing it up. Like, doing things differently, Liv. Like, they're breaking away from tradition but making it a better TV product, I would think.
Not necessarily. Tradition is a good thing in golf.
Yeah. Anything else you're watching? Surely there's some crap you're watching. That actually sounds good.
Watched a bit of High Country the other day.
Yep.
That's on Fox. That's a new show. My brother-in-law had a hand in making all of that happen. Yep. So I love the shots in that. That was great. What else have I been watching? Aussie Gold Rush,
So same stuff.
Same stuff.
Speaking of golf, you're wearing a sort of, what do you call that, a quarter zip sort of polo number.
A bit weird.
You're looking a little bit, floggy.
Am I?
I don't know.
Anyway, come on. We've got a big guest today, by the way.
Yeah, we've got a big, massive guest.
And I mean big.
One of my childhood heroes, an Australian sporting icon, Andrew Bogut, is going to join us.
Probably one of the best, he and Luke Longley, the best big men ever to represent Australia.
Definitely one of the best Australians.
Number one pick in the world.
There's only been two number one picks in the NBA draft. Who was the other one?
What, Australians?
Yep.
The other one was, you got me there.
Yeah.
Should know that.
He's been in the news a lot lately.
Oh, yeah, Simmons.
Ben Simmons.
Yeah.
Yeah, competed for the national team, has really paved the way for a new generation of Australians in the NBA. Before him, there weren't many.
Anyway, he's coming up shortly. Look forward to that.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and other than that, that's pretty much it. So let's crack into him.
Well, Harrison, you mentioned before that we have a special guest today, and of course his name is Andrew Bogut. A lot of people would know him from his basketball background, of course, and some would know from his recent podcasts and political views and the whole box and dies that goes with someone like Andrew. Welcome to you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it is fantastic to have you. You're not living in Victoria anymore.
No, I'm in Queensland at the moment.
Is there a particular reason for that?
Born
in Melbourne.
What area?
Dandenong? Sort of?
I grew up in the southeast suburbs, born in Mulgrave Hospital, early childhood Dandenong, and then we moved to Endeavour Hills, which was two suburbs over.
So basketball at Dandenong was big from my memory.
It was huge, yeah. Dandenong Stadium was probably the biggest catchment at that time. Biggest stadium, probably still is up there as one of the biggest stadiums. They just continued to add courts. As a young fella, went from 6 to 10 to 14 to,
I remember,
I think there's probably 18 there now. So a huge catchment out that way, yeah, for sure.
But you were also playing footy at that. You're playing junior footy, yeah, at this stage?
Not for club. I did the – back when it was called Vic Kick, so it shows my age. It's Oz Kick now, but I did the Vic Kick for a couple of years. I think every kid growing up in Victoria kind of has a footy in their hand at one point, and I really enjoyed footy, really enjoyed playing, but – it got to a point where I had to make a decision. My parents were kind of like, we can't do both. And I think my parents liked that one better because my mum didn't like getting in the car in the muddy winters and sitting outside and all that kind of stuff.
Stadiums were nice.
Bit nicer.
When was it that you felt like you might have had this game, not covered, but you were going to be reasonable at it? Did your height all of a sudden happen at a particular year, or were you always
super
tall?
I was super late. Like, I didn't think I was going to be, I always dreamt about being a professional athlete, but the reality of that didn't set in for me very late, and I think that worked in my favor. I think if I was at the front of the pack at 11, 12, 13, I think it would have hurt me more than helped me. And I think being middle to back, I was always kind of in the middle of the pack or even lower of the pack. It made me continue to fight for what I got to.
Did you have a lot of rejection for like those early, under 16 squads and stuff? Was there a lot of that as you were
I changed club teams twice. I got put in the Dandenong in under 16s. I got put in the third team, not even the second.
Really?
Thirds, yeah. And then left there, went to Waverley for a season. They were division below VC, so I was in the first there. Played there for a season and then went to Sandringham and then took a team that was basically, I've talked about it on my podcast and with numerous people, was a team of kind of delinquents, which fit me perfectly.
Yeah.
A bunch of kids.
Sounds like Coach Carter.
It kind of was. Like, it really was. And a lot of those guys I still talk to this day, and we were kind of all had our separate problems off the floor, and a couple of expelled kids, a couple of kids that would always fight, and it just fit well together.
Nice.
And it was perfect for me. So I was like, this is my team. And then I got emergency on the under 18 state team, so I didn't make the squad. I was an emergency, and that was a blessing in disguise for me. I think it was really good for me because I got to train with this team leading up to the nationals. But obviously, I only get to go if someone gets hurt. No one ever gets hurt in those circumstances. There was a bloke that was 50-50, but he miraculously recovered and made it. But I got to train every weekend with them leading up to it, and I felt like I was going into those sessions just ready to kill them because they took my spot, right? And it just, yeah.
That the first time you started to receive good coaching? Because in the juniors, we all know it's the volunteer mum, it's the volunteer dad. Sometimes they know, sometimes they don't know.
So a lot of footy coaches that coach basketball. Yeah. Take a specky on him.
I remember Harrison had a guy that was a rugby league coach, and I went down and watched him train one night. I thought, what the hell is going on
exactly,
here?
Exactly, right, yeah.
So do you think it could have happened quicker if you'd had, like, the pathways now? If they were then, do you think that would have been better for you or not?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. It's definitely a good question. I think there's a lot of people that try to volunteer and help. There's a lot of good coaches and bad coaches. I think one thing that was never questioned for me was the love and time I spent in the game, even as an 11, 12-year-old. Like I knew I was working more than – and not strategically. I just loved the game. I was outside of my backyard. When it rained, I'd just go inside and watch VHS tapes of NBA action, NBA game of the week until the next one. Next week I could record another one. And I was even going outside to a point where my dad put floodlights out on our veranda so I could shoot till, 8, 9 o'clock till the neighbors started losing their minds of a ball bouncing. So I think it definitely would have helped. But I think, even looking at my kids now and other friends' kids that are training now, you want to be careful that you don't overexpose neither. So I see a lot of kids today, training a boatload at a young age.
There's no need for that, you think?
I think it needs to be a balance. Right. I think you don't want to have a 9, 10-year-old kid training how some of these kids are training, 5, 6, 7 hours a day, because burnout's going to happen eventually. Mm. And then also it's a big toll on your body at a young age. So but on the flip side, you don't want to be doing one a week, right? Like I think there's a happy medium there. Yeah. We see a lot of kids today probably don't do enough, and there's a lot of kids that probably do too much. But I think it's kind of – back in our day, it was probably – we did way too much, whereas these days it's probably on the little scope, but you still got to be careful that you don't overdo it, I think.
There's an author, Malcolm Gladwell, who talks about the 10,000-hour rule. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you would think is true, or is it better to have a mix?
What is the 10,000?
So, master every craft, yeah.
Yeah, so you can explain it. Sorry.
Yeah, so they say in any craft, whether you're a mechanic or podcaster maybe, or a basketball player, you put 10,000 hours into something, you're generally going to be close to a master in that craft.
Right.
And I did the math on mine, and I definitely put – from childhood. That's a lot of hours. You add it up per year, per day. It is a lot of hours, but I definitely would have surpassed
and
that.
In sport, the opposite school of thought is like instead of specifying early at a young age when you're a teenager and doing those hours is like it's better to have to do multiple sports and then hone in your focus when you're 16, 17. So someone like Roger Federer played soccer and tennis and then didn't decide to play either or until he was 16, 17.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of translation in multiple sports, definitely, especially hand-eye coordination stuff. Footy, basketball gets talked about a lot, but even other stuff, like just, I look at a guy like Steph Curry and his ability, his hand-eye, you can just tell he's played multiple sports. Like he could pick up, some random game, let's throw that paper off that, camera to go in over there and he'll once, twice, bang, masters it. And you're just like, you can tell he's done different kinds of things. And you can also the opposite tell people that are just one-hit wonders in one sport. We used to have things at with numerous NBA teams and the national team where you'd warm up with cricket or soccer or rugby and you could see some guys and you're like, they could barely run in a straight line doing a different sport. I was one of those kids that played every sport at school, loved any sport. What are we playing? Let's go. Four wins or losses, which is frowned upon today, but even at a young age, whatever we're playing for a score, and it was cricket, it was baseball, it was kickball, whatever it was, loved it, and I think that really helped for becoming a professional athlete.
Before you went over to the States to play with Utah in college, you went to the AIS Academy. So what was that like? I guess it's a bunch of kids all just living in Canberra with nothing else to do other than to play sport. What's that
I've
like?
I've heard about these days.
Yeah, I think I just went back to the AIS and just walked around and did a clinic there for Basketball Australia. I've been back once since I left. This was the second time and I hadn't seen all the renovations and stuff, but it just brought back so much butterflies and fond memories because that was, looking back, probably, obviously not making money at that time and all the stuff that comes with going to the NBA, that was probably the most fun time of my life, like looking back, because it was just, like you said, we all lived in these blocks. We all had our own little room with our own little sink, shared bathrooms, had to use a washing facility. This is 16 years old. You had to learn how to wash your own clothes, keep your room clean, all that kind of stuff. And then you're just with the boys all the time.
Is it still as strong as it was?
Yeah, it is. It is. Most of the good players come through that program. They now have the NBA Academy, NBA Australia Academy, or this side of the world Academy, which has a few guys from Asia and whatnot as well. So they have the AIS squad. They have an NBA Australia squad as well. But it's just great. It teaches you how to live with people you might not like, teaches you about having teammates that you love and teammates teammates that you don't like, but you got to figure it out on the floor. We had guys punching on off the floor. We had banter. We had all this kind of stuff. We had some trimmings with the law at times and got in some trouble there. So sneaking into nightclubs at 16, like it was just all that kind of you know, stuff that you do as a young fellow where you learn. And Marty Clark, who's now the head coach of the academy there, he was the head coach of the AIS, and he laughs about we were probably the worst team he had off the court as far as indiscretions and trouble. We were the best team on the court.
Right. Who were some of the other names like in the AIS Academy, basketball or not, that were there when you were there?
Brad Newley, Aaron Bruce, Stevie Markovich, Alex Marich, myself. You know, we had a lot of really good players that went on to be really good in college, NBL, and Europe. But it was just a good group, and it was a bunch of – we had a lot of guys that were fringe their state teams in that squad, funnily enough. We had a few that were household names, but then we had myself, Alex Marich, you know, guys that were always fighting for everything they had, and we just had a really good group of guys that put it together. But it was really fun. And then that team, then I think 10 out of the 12 players from the AIS made the under-19 Australian team that won the first ever gold medal in 2003. We went over and just smashed everyone and played really well,
So what was the step from there to college? Were you going from there to college because you knew you wanted to play NBA basketball, or was it just an opportunity to go to college? What was it?
I was just flying blind. I mean, the NBA was a unicorn for me. It was like, yeah, of course, I'd love to play in the NBA, but I didn't think it was realistic.
It was far-fetched.
Yeah, I was like, you know, Luke Longley was really, you know, Anstey had stints.
Andrew Gaze had a little.
Gaze, you know, didn't really play much when it sat on the bench. Shane Heal, kind of the same. Bradkey was there for a small stint. Luke was really the only guy that played multiple years at a high level and played big minutes and won championships. So I'm like, the odds aren't great in 23 years.
Not at all.
Since the 80s. So to me, it was like, if someone's going to give me money to play basketball, I'll go to Estonia if I have to. Like, that was kind of my mindset. And then just went.
And most Australians did have to go to Europe, didn't they?
Europe or college and then come back to the NBL and then fight for an NBL spot. The NBL was in a decent spot at that time when I left, and then it kind of went down, and now it's back up where it is. But Utah recruited me my first year in the AIS. I signed a letter of intent early on. I was supposed to go over after my first year in the AIS. There was an issue with my transcripts about some classes that I did. I did a class that was a half physical, half social science. NCAA said it's one or the other. You can't have half and half. And we're from a different country. Like, it's different. It's different here. So whichever one I picked, I was short of credit on the other one. So then I had to stay back 6 more months, and I just did like four social sciences just to get my credits. And then I went over. But I just went over just trying to better myself. Rick Majerus, the late Rick Majerus, was the head coach there. Probably one of the hardest, most in-your-face coaches in college basketball history, up there with Bobby Knight. Winning his coach in Utah basketball history, I think the 90% at home record. Insane, plus Salt Lake, the altitude helped as well. But I went there for him, and then it was tough. It made me – he was a coach that made you question your love for basketball on a daily basis. And then he ended up leaving mid-season with some what was supposed to be some health issues, but ended up just being some other stuff, off the court stuff, and ended up leaving. And then that kind of unlocked my game even more. He kind of put me in a little bit of a cage with the way my skill set was. Didn't like some things that I did, so wasn't letting me do certain things on the court. And I started to play a little bit scared to make a mistake under him, which was never a good thing in any sport, right? And then he left. I played really well towards the end of that season, and then we got a new coach the following season, and I had a All-American year, swept every award, and ended up going to the NBA.
The NCAA Player of the Year.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not too bad. When you speak about college, it's a very different system to a lot of places. Obviously, back then they didn't pay players, or you weren't allowed to get any endorsements. A little bit different now, the rules have changed. But what were did you have any college recruiting stories from your times around there? I've heard of suitcases with cash, like, to lure these athletes into the programs?
No, I was kind of wasn't heavily recruited early on in my AIS journey, and then Utah got on me early through Brian Gorgian. He called Rick Majerus and said, you got to come look at this kid, and he was like, done, we'll sign him, whatever. So I always had a loyalty to Utah, and I never really had – I didn't even take a recruiting trip.
I was
kind of so focused on, you know, Majerus can get you to the next level, whether that's Europe or the NBA. I don't care about all the party stuff. I don't need to be visited and schmoozed. And we all know the stories that happens, and there's numerous kids that do it. I was never going to be fazed by good-looking girls or parties or that. I was kind of like basketball was kind of that's what I'm thinking yeah. about. And look, what I come to figure is anywhere in the world, if you want to find trouble and party and have a good time, you can find it. Right? That's one thing you end up learning because you're just like, oh, Utah, boring, this and that. I had a great time there.
Have you heard of anyone, any of those stories around like the offers to lure athletes in?
Yeah, I had numerous teammates in the NBA. I had one guy that told me that he was in a recruiting meeting with a school. And I think he had them in his top three and they said, okay, do you want to sign? And he's like, nah, look, you guys are in my top three. Let me go home and think about it. And they're like, okay. And they just whacked the duffel bag on the table with 50K USD in hard cash and said, how's that decision now? And he's like, done. He's like, you know, so like that happened all the time. I was the opposite. That's one gripe I had with the NCAA. I was into first year I lived on campus. So received no money. Second year, you think you're a bigwig. I go, I'm going to move off campus because I get a check every month for to live off campus. And then once I committed to it, I did the math and I'm like, ooh, bad decision. it was $750 a month USD. And then international, I didn't realize international because I wasn't a resident. I got slapped at $100 tax on top of that. So I had $650 to pay my rent, my petrol, all my expenses. And fuel to get to campus, which was 15 minutes
away. Living off the smell of an oily rag.
I was in the negative. I had to go, and this is all meanwhile, I walk in the bookstore, they're selling my jersey. You know, I can't make money, I can't do anything. So
it's crazy. Crazy.
We approached a booster with our club at the time, because I went to the coach and I said, mate, I can't afford to eat. Like, I have to take food from our post-game meals and box them and have those for the next couple of days in the microwave. And a sponsor of ours owned a Skybox sports bar, which was in downtown Salt Lake. He goes, I can get you a job there. And I was working Friday and Saturday night.
I can get you a job, not get you food or money or anything. I can get you a job.
Which is probably $7 an hour or something.
Nah, they looked after me. I ended up getting $20 an hour.
That's good in America.
Because like, I couldn't serve.
You were underage, under 21.
Because I was under 21. So as a waiter, all I was the food runner. So the chefs would make the food and I just helped the waitresses carry it on the tray. Yeah. And I couldn't even really talk to people. People would be like, hey, can I place an order? I'm like,
not me. Were you tall then?
Yeah. Well, no, I was 7 foot and I was an all-American candidate going into that sophomore year. So like, it's a sports bar restaurant. So everyone I drop stuff off to want to have a chat. Oh,
fans are probably going to that shop to see you.
But I work 5-hour shifts on a Friday from 5 till 10 and on a Saturday 5 till 10 on top of going to school and all my practice. Once games start, I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
This was all in the preseason. But it kind of made me resent NCAA a little bit because I was like, this isn't right. Like, and I didn't want millions of dollars. I was like, if you give me like $2,000 to $3,000 a semester, $4,000 a semester, I'm living like a king. Yeah. At least I can take a girl out to dinner. I can go to movies. I can do any of that. And it was like I had no insurance in my car for a period of time, which was illegal. Like, it was all that kind of stuff. And I was like, man, this is hard. But, you know, ended up obviously working out.
So you go from that and then you become the first Australian to be the number one pick. You go to Milwaukee Bucks.
No, hang on.
Okay.
Not just the number one pick. You know, like, you look at it, the NBA number one pick, right? I think it's bigger than that. It's effectively the number one pick in the world.
Yeah,
it's effectively the number one pick of any junior basketballer in the world, college basketball, you name it. It's not just the NBA pick one. So get that right in your head first.
So you go from that to working at the local bar to, I'm not sure what the first contracts are. I know they're locked in, but millions of dollars on the table, playing for Milwaukee, traveling across America. What's that like? What was the adjustment like?
Oh, it wasn't adjustment. Early on, I was too young and too stupid to have it make a difference. I knew I had cash.
Spending ridiculously?
I bought my parents a house and bought them both cars, new cars. Bought my sister a car. And then I wasn't living in anything too crazy. I just 3-bedroom apartment that I was renting in downtown Milwaukee. Didn't even have a car. I didn't buy a car the first couple of years because I had a car deal with a local car company there. And I just didn't really focus on money at all. I just kind of was like, had a financial advisor. I'm like, you deal with that. I just want to focus on basketball for the first couple of seasons. And
is that rare? Like, do you
No. Yeah, I mean, there's some guys that go a bit crazy, but I didn't want to. I've read all those stories about guys going broke. So
they're horror stories, aren't they?
I think it's something like, I think it's 3 and 4. I think it's
The percentages were high.
It's 80%. 3 and 4. Within 5 years of retirement are in dire straits financially.
What's the average lifespan of an NBA player in terms of being in the league?
I think think it's 3 to 4. It's short.
Similar in AFL, isn't it?
Yeah. Because you factor all the delistings in and the fringe guys, they hit that number, right, to bring the averages down. But
so you did 15 years, I think.
14. Yeah.
14 years, yeah.
And with that spending of people when they get all this money and, you know, they've got lots of family and friends, is it like the buying of the cars and the spending, or is it having your family and friends sort of on the payroll and looking after people and but overdoing it?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, and this is where it gets dicey. So generally, a lot of people think it's a bad business deal, but you'll do one of those. Everyone's going to be, you know, have a bad deal go over or whatever, or invest in a nightclub or something stupid that you shouldn't have invested in, right? One thing you learn, especially if you're investing in the hospitality industry, is you need to be there. Like if you're investing in a friend's restaurant or a bar, like there's no incentive for them to make sure it's running right because they've got the cash behind it, right? You got to be there every day. For me, most times I saw issues was family. Yeah. Mm. It was family on payroll, family on, you know, I had a teammate that was traveling his family to all our NBA finals games, staying in the same hotel as us, staying, you know, eating where we're eating. And I'm like, man, that's expensive. Because don't forget, during NBA finals, they rent those hotel rooms go up 3 to 4x, you know, in some cities, right? And I'm like doing the math and I'm like, man, he's not making that much money. Like, you know, and I think right now he's okay, but I don't think he's.
So I was talking to Dylan Buckley just outside before about this, and he wanted to find out from, like, at their peak, probably not you, because you sound relatively normal and you had control of things, but perhaps someone else in the NBA, how many people would they have on their payroll at their peak, do you think? Is it just their management?
How much money are we talking?
Is it just their management team, or are there others?
There's definitely others. It all depends on who they are. Like max guys would have numerous people. Like max contract guys, 30, 40 million a year. They'd have, you know, some guys have full-time physios, full-time chefs that live in, plus their family. A lot of guys will pay their best friend to live with them, which is an interesting one. They'll pay their best friend a couple hundred K. You're my boy. You go out to the clubs with me. You just live at home and do nothing. Play video games. I don't want to play video games with you. So basically like a rent-a-friend. And I was always like,
I wonder what that is like for that person. Like it'd be good for a while, but don't you want to have a sense of purpose?
You would, but some guys are just like, if you're from the hood or from a bad area you probably got no prospects and you're like, your best friend just made it or cousin or whatever just made it to the NBA and they're like, come live with me in this city, because a lot of guys are lonely as well. They might not have a wife at that point in their life, especially in a young phase. Now you've got a wingman and go to clubs with you and party and do you know, if you're not at home and something happens, hey, take my card, get it cleaned. Hey, I need this. Basically, you're a PA essentially. Yeah. But those I noticed never end well. They never end well because either the guy ends up getting greedy and stealing off that person, their access to bank accounts. There's been a few cases where they've taken down the player's wife or missus while he's not there, you know. So there's all kinds of stuff going on with that. And I was always kind of like, I'm not paying someone to be my fucking friend. Can I say on this podcast?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not paying someone to be my fucking friend. Like, it's just ridiculous. I'm just like, I just couldn't get my head around it. I'm going to pay you to be like, yeah, you're the best, but who's will? Let's go party. Like, I'm good. I'll just ride solo. And I was always happy in kind of my own space at times. And that's the other thing that people don't talk about is a lot of pro athletes I saw hate their own company. They just cannot get to go on the road. Sometimes I would just love to get to the room, order room service, chuck a movie on, lounge back, game the next day. Guys would sit in their room for an hour, got to go out, got to go do something. You know, and it was actually, you felt bad for some of the guys because they just could not stand their own company.
Wow.
Where are some of the best places to go on the road to travel for that?
For partying and all that?
Just for fun, like?
It depends. I mean, LA was always good when we were in Milwaukee, just because whenever we went West Coast, we were in Milwaukee, so it was cold and you'd always go there. It'd be nice, palm trees, you know, it'd be 25 degrees, and get some sun. I'd just go chill by the pool where the hotels we were at, and especially in LA, you see all kinds of things by the pool. So that was always fun. The party city is obviously Miami. South Beach is probably the number one aspect. But like I said—
But literally how long in each city? Is it like football here? You're literally 24 hours there.
It depends. If you have a back-to-back, you'll fly out straight after the game and go to the next city. Some coaches strategically will get out of those cities as soon as they can. Like if we played in – we had Scott Skiles was generally, if we played in Miami, we'd fly out straight after, even though we didn't have anything the next day, just because he's like, get us out of here because I know guys are going to be out on the town. But then like Steve Kerr was big on staying over that night because a sleep specialist said it's better to get on your sleep track and then fly out in the morning. So every coach is different. Some coaches, you know, and we were winning in Golden State, so – Kerr was pretty lenient with what the guys wanted to do. But
when you say fly out, are you flying all together?
Like private or you're flying?
Yeah, charter. Yeah, we can't. I mean, the guys back in the day, you tip your hat to them how they did it without charter. It's brutal.
Be a nightmare.
It's brutal. And we had they've stopped them now, but like for 10 years of my career, we had four and fives, I would call it, 4 and 5 nights with travel. So you might be home away, day off, home away. So you're just like, and you get into cities sometimes at 2, 3 a.m. You got a game that same day, right? So it's,
wow. See, I'm always blown away that by that because I think these guys travel so much. When do you get the chance to actually train and put things together? Because it's such a theoretical game as well and such a pre-practice game. When do you get the chance to do that?
Yeah, preseason is really important, even though it's short. It's only about a month with exhibition games. But a lot of it's mental. A lot of it's these days is film watching. A lot of it, there's a lot of walkthroughs. So we'll do simulation type, they call it in footy or rugby, I guess, where you walk through stuff. Sometimes it will even... You know, if we have a back-to-back and we fly, let's say we play tonight in LA and then tomorrow we're in Portland, so we flew, we won't have a training session before the game, they might tape down some lines in the ballroom at one of the hotels and we'll walk through some stuff. This is home on a guard, this play and that play. So they've tapered it off a lot, but it is hard. And the travel for me was probably the hardest part. That was the hardest adjustment. All the games, yes, a lot of games. And this was back when when I first started, there was none of this rest period stuff and load management. That probably came in the last 5 or 6 years. But it is hard and you just got to do your best to recover. There's no excuse out there.
Am I right in saying or in believing that I look at Steph Curry and I go, I think that guy shoots more than any other player in the competition and that is why he's good. He seems to – I have this feeling that he's like – he's training in his sleep almost. Is that something that I'm reading wrong or is that true?
It's a mix. He's an it player that just has it.
All right.
Like I said,
okay. Well, that's
he's one of those guys that could, but no, but let me finish. He does put in the hours. So it's a mix of both, and that's why he's so good. Like I said, he could make up some game right here on the spot. He's just got that part of his brain and can just put it all together really, really easily with whatever you're doing. And he walks up to a dartboard, never touched a dart, he'd have a bullseye in 20 shots. One of those guys, but yes, he also puts in a boatload of time.
What's he like off the court, like as a personality? He seems like, given, for people who don't know basketball, best player on the team, win championships, and then Kevin Durant, one of the best players in the league also, comes to the team. Mm. He's still able to maintain, you know, this is my team, but also give the car keys to Kevin Durant.
Or did he?
Not many NBA players can do that ego wise.
No, and that's why I respect him. He let another Max guy and also a Nike guy. You know,
so there's a bit of that. Yeah, he's Under Armour. Yeah,
was Under Armour. Was,
oh, really? You know,
basically, the face of the Warriors is Under Armour.
Yeah,
and you bring in Nike. So that whole dynamic. There were some rumblings that, you know, KD wasn't too happy with all the stardom that Steph was getting. Who knows if there's truth to that? That was all reported. But I mean, Steph's just. I really enjoy being around him. One of the few superstars that is kind of what he preaches for the most part. Family man. I've never seen him, you know, out doing nefarious things, all those kind of things. Like generally you have you have a lot of players that preach all that stuff publicly, and that's when I lost a lot of respect for a lot of players that preach whatever they're preaching, and then they're doing the opposite behind the scenes. But we used to play poker on the plane. He was in the poker group myself. It was me, Clay, and Draymond. Most road trips would play the duration of the flight. And
Are you playing for money?
Yeah.
Give us like a dollar of that.
Oh, we've had some big flights. Like, the game wasn't too big considering what kind of games I've played in before. You know, 5, 10, 20K sometimes guys would lose. I'm saying big money in context of what we're earning.
Yeah, right? You put it into perspective.
People listen to
this
like, oh, fuck you, Bogut. Well, that's a lot of money. But in the context of what's been made, Steph's making 30, 40 million. I was making 12 million a year, Draymond, you know. So, but we had a few days where there was some cars lost, put it that way.
So you mentioned Draymond Green there. Like, I want to like him. I want to like him. But when I'm sitting there, I'm cringing sometimes. I go, oh, please shut up, mate.
Well, similar to the way you played.
Yeah, probably.
I thought you'd love him.
I do. I want to like him. Does he go – I don't know whether I went over the top, but does
what
he
goes
go
on
over
his
the
brain?
Top? Yeah, what goes on? What sort of guy is he?
He's a hot and cold guy. Like, you either love him or you hate him.
Right.
As a teammate, you love him. As an opponent, you hate him. I understand fans will either love or hate the guy, but he's a prime example of a guy that – if you change what he does and who he is, he's not the player he is.
Right.
So he's a prime. I talked to when I talk to young kids and I talk to parents about, and even junior coaches, I want the kid that I got to put back on the rails every now and then.
Right.
Right. I want that kid that like is giving me everything and he's so
pushing the limits,
and, and emotional. And then, you know, once every fortnight, you got to be like, hey, mate, get back on here. I'd rather that than someone like, oh, man.
He's a yes, man.
Yeah. No, no, no. Give us some effort. Come on, man. Like, I don't I don't want to coach that. And that's Draymond. Like, yeah, you're going to have to put him back on the tracks every now and then. But that other 90%, you get elite, all in, ready to fight, ready to punch, ready to
scrap.
Yeah, and you want – like, every team in the league would take that. Yeah, it can be grinding on a daily basis. Draymond and I have got into it off the court, on the court. We've had – you know, but then I love him as a teammate because
– That's because you both care so much about
fight.
The result.
He's going to fight. He's going to say and do things that are unpleasant at times, and he's going to admit that, you know, he's wrong a lot of those times, punching his teammate, that was wrong, all that kind of stuff. But – you know, that's what makes him. If Steve Kerr goes to him and says, "Oh, we need you to tone it down," he's not the same player. And then you don't want to tone that down.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, Steve would love a little less ejections and a little less punches thrown. But that's what makes him up. I think he's number two also in all time ejections. So he's
all time. Surprising.
All time.
Wow. Who's number one, by the way? Do you know?
Rasheed Wallace. I think he's eight away from Rasheed. So we had a little thing on my podcast. We had an over-under with my co-host.
Oh, he'll get there.
He'll get there.
You think he'll get there? You think he'll get there? I think he's 21 or 22.
Couple,
I think
Rasheed's
29.
Years to go. Yeah. He's got a couple of good years left in him.
Three or four more a year. Yeah. He'll get the all-time record.
Yeah, he'll get there. Yeah. IQ, like I reckon most basketball, maybe I'm wrong in thinking that. I just think that most basketballers got pretty good IQ for their sport. Who is there one that stands out that you go, wow, that guy is ahead of the rest in terms of understanding what the hell we're trying to get here?
I think that most of that Golden State squad, we won it. Like Draymond's up there. That's why, I mean, I was a defensive-orientated player late in my career, and Draymond was a defensive-orientated player. So him and I at the 4-5 was just – it was – we didn't have to talk about shit. It was just he's doing that. I need to do this. I need to cover him here. It was just automatic. That wasn't practice. A lot of people were like, oh, did you guys practice that? Nah. So it's like we just understood the game so well. Throw in Steph Curry's pretty high IQ. Andre Iguodala, next level IQ on the perimeter as a defender. Yep. So like we had a really good crew of guys that just knew how to play by reads. Like we didn't really, and that was a beauty of playing in that team. Even offensively, Steve like really when he came in, all he really honed in on was like you guys just need to turn the ball over less. That's where I see the number. If we can get our turnovers down 2 to 3 a game, win a championship. And he really stuck to his guns on that. But the rest was just kind of he put in some small tweaks to that offense. But for the most part, we just ran in a perpetual flow motion. Where we just all read and react stuff, and it's hard to scout, it's hard to watch film on. You take away one thing, we've got a secondary, third, fourth, fifth option, and there was a freedom to just continuously break off plays if we felt there was an advantage there, and it was just a fun way to play.
What about the Boomers? You're the backbone of the Boomers for so long. Where are the Boomers held in world basketball? I'm thinking about, and you mentioned Steve Kerr there, who's involved with the national team over there, and perhaps other really well-known basketball. What do they think of the Australian team? What have they thought for the last 20 years of the Australian team generally, do you think? Where's it stood?
Yeah, tough, physical, going to fight you. I mean, we generally we had the talent all through probably the 90s. We had a lot of talent, you know, Brad Keys, Gaze, Vlahov, Luke when he played. And then it phased out probably after the 2000 Olympics because we had such a push of everyone wanted to play in the 2000 Olympics. Yeah. That was Australian, right? Because like, it's on home soil. But we probably had a few guys on their last legs. So then what happened was once they all played that, they retired. There was like, oh shit, who's in the pipeline? There was no one left. It was like a transition period. So I came in at that point and we weren't very good. But we weren't very talented, but we were going to fight you. But we just didn't have the talent to win games. Late in games, we'd lose just to the experienced teams. Now my only concern with the national team is we got to make sure that identity stays with the talent that we have. Now our talent's also up there with world talent, right? Yep. Can we maintain that Aussie grit and toughness and grind? And that's where it gets a bit tricky. Do you fall into this, you know, you're 7-8 months a year, you're a rock star in the NBA. Is that now going to infiltrate the national team? And there's been remnants of it. I'm not going to lie. There's been remnants of it over the last 3 or 4 years, maybe even more, even when I was kind of phasing out. And that's the biggest challenge with national teams is like – everyone, no matter where you play, even if you look at Chris Golding, he's the man on his team. You know, you look at all these other players, Avery Cooks in Japan, then you got, they're all 1, 2, 3 options on the team. You come into a national team at 12, it's like, we don't need you to be the number one option.
We just need you to play 2 minutes.
Exactly. And then some guys can't buy into that.
Yeah.
So then our whole thing was leave your bullshit at the door, buy into your role. some guys just can't do that. And that's the trickiest, hardest thing for a national team is making sure you've got full buy-in. And the coach has tough decisions. Do I bring a guy in as the 12th man who might cause me problems because he's not playing minutes? Or do I just bring a young guy that's going to be happy to be there? And then you've got that whole conundrum, and it's a hard, hard job to kind of pick that. And then also you got to have in mind a little bit of a focus on the coming generation. So you've got some longevity. You don't want to go back to a point where you're 2000 Olympics or your big dog retire and you're like, no one's left.
Is my visualisation of Paddy Mills on the bench in the background waving the flag because one of his teammates has done something good and always accepting of that? Is he one that is accepting of it?
That's going to be the question with this coming tournament, I think.
Yeah, because he's getting older.
I think he's phasing out.
Yeah.
He's not the player he once was, and it happens to us all. It happened to me. I mean, towards the end of my Boomers career, Andre Lemanis came to me and said, I want to bring you off the bench. And I was like, oh, man, that kind of hurts a little bit, but I get it. I understand. Right. But I was still finishing games, right?
Yeah.
But he wanted to go a little bit different with the start, a bit younger.
So you play less minutes, but finishing's the important?
Finishing's important basketball, yeah. That's obviously still got the trust in that you're going to finish the game and make the right decisions. But I think I'd love to see a role for Paddy, you know, towards the end of his Boomers career of just being that gunner off the bench. I think it suits him really well. But will he accept that? Will that decision happen? Who knows? That's a decision for Gorgon. But, you know, he's not great defensively. And his offense is definitely what makes him elite. But I think if you can play him smaller minutes, instead of playing him 30 to 35 in these tournaments, you play him 20 to 25 off the bench with a massive punch. And then the other thing is I think him and Giddy aren't a good fit together because they both need the ball. So
yeah, right.
Giddy's kind of the future of the team. Ball's in his hands. It's kind of obsolete to have him and Paddy in the same lineup throughout the whole game. I think if you kind of split their minutes, it provides a bit more of a balance.
You've obviously represented the country on multiple occasions in massive tournaments, and you've done a great job at that. The 2000 Olympics, if it's held in 2000 and the COVID era didn't happen, you obviously stepped away from the game around that time.
2021, you mean?
Paris. Yeah, 2020. Japan. Yeah, but the games was in 2021. Yep. Do you think you play if it's 2020?
Yeah, no, yep. I was all
in. You're ready. Yeah, you're so sliced up.
Look, my back, coming back to the NBL, my back was like it was a daily grind. Like it was really hard. Just getting right for some games. It was an hour treatment before and after and a lot of stuff throughout the week just to maintain, be able to play the next week. And that was just in the NBL. So I went back to the Warriors for that stint, came back, and then my back that second year in the NBL was just not great. So I was like, man, like, I don't think I'm going to play much more. Just two young kids. Went to the park one day. I'm trying to push them on a swing. Could barely do it because of my back. And I'm like, this is no way. It's not good for my kids neither. It's not fair to them. It's literally lying on the floor most days between games. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to, like, mentally, I put a plan out. I'm going to play this second year in the NBL, push all the chips on the table, get to Japan, and then I'm going to announce my retirement.
In 2020.
In 2020, I'm going to announce my retirement after those games. And then COVID happens. It gets delayed, and I'm like, oh, shit, I got to, you know, now it's in 21. I got to probably sign somewhere else for another season, which would be Sydney if I was going to do it. And I was like, I just don't have it in me. I just don't have another 7 or 8 months of that constant grind. It would have been 12 months. Of that constant grind to get myself right to play for those Olympics, and I'd be limping in, and I was like,
and a bronze medal, like it hurts.
Yeah, it does. Stings. It does. Missing out on that, but I was happy for the boys. I mean, it was a long, long journey. I still feel like I was part of kind of that journey to an extent, but not getting it. You know, it is what it is. That's the brutal reality of sport. But I still, you know, I feel like I got to spend more time with my kids. There was a bonus with that, but I just know I would have been limping in there anyway. I don't think I would have been much use in another year's time. With the way my body was kind of starting to break down.
There'd be a lot of coke, and I don't mean Coca-Cola in the NBA, a lot of cocaine and other drugs, other illicit drugs. Do they have a policy over there like we do here in football?
I haven't seen a lot of coke.
Do they have an illicit drugs policy?
Yeah, so yeah, if you get pinged, I think OJ Mayo got done for I think ecstasy or MDMA.
Yeah.
I can't remember what he got done for.
Penalty would be?
He got booted out of league.
Ah.
But there's
one strike?
We have strikes, but the harder classes of drugs, more severe punishment.
Right.
Weed, obviously, they're pretty lax. Yeah. Like weed's, you know.
Nothing.
Weed might be the one that most people were doing. I think now they've really freed up those rules as well. I think you can medicinals all allowed now and stuff
so
like
were you
that.
Disappointed in the AFL and their code, the way it's structured or not?
I commented on this and got some, you know, media attention from it last week. I think it's pretty simple. I think the AFL back 15, 20 years ago was told by the federal government to implement the WADA code for funding. So
yep.
The AFL had to do it to get cash from the government,
right,
and continue to get money for facilities and all that kind of stuff. But then the AFL was like, shit, we've got a bit of an issue, so let's just try to appease the WADA code, but also make sure we've all heard stories about players in the AFL about on the eighth and ninth strike, right? You guys have heard the same stories I have.
Yeah.
Right? So, and look, it is what it is. It's they have to deal with that. Look, to say it's not happening in the NBA, of course it is. I'm sure there is cocaine. I've never seen hard drugs, but I also wasn't a guy that was going out partying every night.
AFL is the only sport in Australia that has an illicit drugs policy, though, and all other sports are receiving funding from the government. Do you think it's...
Today, yes, but back then when the AFL got their big leg up, or when the AFL was really ascending, it was a big push from government funding back then in the early 2000s, right? It was
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. There's money going both ways if you do it right.
My whole point with all that was the hypocrisy of the AFL preaching to us about every social matter under the sun, every different round's themed, to then be doing this under their own watch. I think it's pretty hypocritical. That's my whole point of it. It's like, so then, you know, the end of that is like, don't preach to the masses when you got a bit of a fire in your own house, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you go back to your career? We haven't talked much about actually playing. So obviously you've done it all, Pinnacle, winning a championship, playing with Milwaukee for those first eight or so years. Is that about right?
Yep.
You go from being one of the guys at Milwaukee, getting traded to the Warriors, and essentially that was the decision made by the Warriors front office to say, this is Steph Curry's team, because Monte Ellis goes out, he goes to Milwaukee, you go to the Warriors. What's it like adjusting from being one of the guys to playing a different role within that Warriors ecosystem?
Yeah, it was a challenge at the start. Number one, number two option for the most of 7-8 years I'm in Milwaukee. You know, some nights they're coming to you, whether you're 1-for-10 or whether you're 9-for-10 from the field, we still have to
make
go to
play.
You. Yeah. Make a play. So going from that and being able to play through mistakes where you're like, you know, you're struggling tonight, but we've got another choice, you're our guy, to then go on to the Warriors and you know, I realized pretty quickly that I've got Klay Thompson and Steph Curry on the wings and they should be shooting most of the shots because they're just shooting at elite level. I'd be an idiot to be like, I still want my 20 touches a night. Like, I'd be like, all right, mate, see you later.
So do you think right at this time it was a changing game a little bit? It was going from the big man to
100%.
To the wings?
Yeah, become much more perimeter orientated, open floor style, less post-ups. But my skill set fit that system with Golden State so perfectly. Don't forget, when I got traded to Golden State sucked.
Yeah.
It was a losing season again.
Why did it? So, you say it's because you're a good passer? Is that why?
Me fitting in?
Yeah.
So we had guys that, like Steph and Klay, that spread the court a lot shooting wise. They could move well off the ball. Then you factor in Harrison Barnes, super athletic, Andre Iguodala, Draymond Green, guys that knew how to play. David Lee was there at the time. We had a bunch of guys
that could
spread the floor. And then if guys are, you know, getting overplayed, I could just pick apart, you know, backdoor passes and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Set really physical screens. And then on the flip side, we were pretty bad defensively when I had arrived. Then you draft Draymond, myself. We had Festus Ezeli as my backup, all defensive-orientated guys. Our defense shot up as well, and we provided a good balance.
You just mentioned defense then. You know, he made a huge difference in the defense when he went to the Warriors. I think we were in the second defensive team.
Yeah, all second
that
team.
Year,
second,
in the championship winning year?
The second year, yeah. The one that we let go, the 3-1.
Right. Yeah.
So for the casual NBA difference. Fan, what Andrew's talking about is this team coming together and the evolution of this over a couple of years to 2015-16 was a literal massive change and shift in the way the NBA was played.
For like, a shit team.
And the Warriors. The Warriors were, I think they had one playoff run in like 20 years.
Yeah.
It was like insane.
Steph Curry and Klay Thompson changed the game and how they shoot the ball and the amount of shots they're putting up from three, spreading the floor. Like, it's a massive change. How many three-pointers did you get to shoot in your time at the Warriors?
I shot them in college, but I phased that out in the NBA, especially after the elbow injury, which really kind of changed the direction of my career as well.
That really affected your shot?
Offensively, yeah.
So that was a massive, when you played at Milwaukee against the Suns, like a fast break. I think I've seen the footage.
I've seen it on YouTube. Little shove, couldn't hang on the rim, fell parallel to the ground, stupidly stuck my elbow. I wish I was doing jiu-jitsu at that point because I would have known how to tuck the shoulder.
That's right, yeah.
Put the arm out, bang. And
horrible.
Just basically everything in my right arm. Broke my index, broke my wrist on both sides, elbow, broke it and fully dislocated it.
Wow.
And chipped bone off. So then the next 2 years we're just trying to get mobility back whilst playing. So the next season I stupidly came back. I was back on the floor for the next season. So I did this in like February, March, and I was back in September, which I shouldn't have been. It should have been close to a 6 to 9 month injury, but hard-headed, stupid, young, wanting to get back on the court.
And you had a career year that year as well.
The year I got hurt, yeah. That was my best year, and I was starting to really figure it out offensively. I was obviously learning defensively and getting better there, but offensively starting to piece it all together. And then that next year was just a struggle. Lucky I have a left hand that was pretty good for a weekend. So kind of like footy, I could kick with my left. I could shoot my left pretty well and went left a lot of the times and still had a decent year that following year. But I was complaining about – I was getting like a – 1 out of 10 times I'd shoot, it felt like someone was jamming a knife in my elbow. Couldn't figure out what was going on. And I'm telling the trainers and they're like, yeah, mate, just suck it up. You'll be right. And I'm like, nah, something's not right. Like every now and then, like I'd literally be shooting fine and then I'd shoot an air ball that would be 5 feet short. And I'm like – what the hell's going on? So then I'm trying to figure out my offense with that. Anyway, the season ends. I go get a scan. I had a massive floating bone that was just moving around in there. So every now and then it was just hitting the bone.
Yeah.
Elbow joint as it is pretty small. So I get it cleaned out and it's a pretty decent chunk. I get it in a vial, go to the trainer and be like.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like, I was right. Man.
Like, yeah. You're making me feel like I was just a hypochondriac. Like like, oh, you're fine. Just suck it up.
Yeah.
Even the coaches at times are like, mate, you know, I was a tip my elbow. But that's the NBA. It's just kind of like, get out there, shut up.
Park that on the coach's desk.
So 2015, you win the championship with the Warriors. The next year, the team gets even better. You mm-hmm. break the wins record. And then you go to the finals against LeBron and you get hurt in game 5.
Yep.
And you're up 3-1. The Cavs end up winning it.
And Draymond gets suspended too. So yeah. It was a
if game, Andrew game if Andrew Bogut plays to...
Oh, who knows? Going back,
come on!
I think
I wasn't moving the needle offensively, but I had a really good defensive series that series. You know, I got LeBron at the rim a lot. I know when I was on the floor and he was turning the corner, getting on the rim, he was looking for me. Like he knew I was coming, and I'm at least contesting him at the rim. One thing, once I went out of that lineup, he was on the rim. He was really on the rim for those last 3 games. Draymond being out in game 5 for the suspension, so we're up 3-1. Come home for game 5. You know, they're already preparing the champagne and stuff in the back. And we lose that game. I do my knee, and then momentum's a funny thing. That's why the 7-game series to me is one of the best series in basketball because so much can happen.
Yeah.
And they were saying was 3-2 going back to Cleveland. We just got to get this one. The pressure's back on them.
Comes
down to a final shot in game 7.
Kyrie
hits that huge shot and they steal it. And that one still hurts because we would have gone down as the greatest team of all time with the 73-9.
Wow, you're not directly guarding Curry because he's a guard, but what's it like watching him run around? I'm sure it's similar to Steph, but is it just a nightmare?
Yeah, he's probably one of the most, probably the best finisher for a guard his size of all time, in my opinion, in the paint.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, he's just
creatively
the stuff that he just throws up. He just up and under bigs, and I saw a video someone was talking about when he was young because I'm wondering how he's like so good at just spinning it off from weird angles. They said as a young fella growing up, I think he grew up in New York, I think, or somewhere up that way in the East. The hoop that he used to shoot on was like missing parts of the backboard, like chunks of it missing. So he had to like figure out unique ways. And you can see that in his game. He's just so good. And
finger
he was
rolls.
Always a tough guy to block. I just knew like just go straight up, make it. Take away the space. He's going to flip something up, and most times it's going to go in. You just got to deal with it. But he's just a lead and a big shot maker. Like he makes big shots late in game. So I like Dallas for that very reason. I don't like them generally as a team as a whole. But when you got two guys like Doncic and Kyrie on one team in a playoff series, you got closers like that, you can do some damage. So I think they'll be pretty okay in this playoff.
What do you think the next evolution of basketball could be? We've seen the big men, you know, from the 70s, 80s and 90s go out to the perimeter game with Steph and Thompson and all those great shooters. What could be next? Is there something that's obvious that could be next, or is it? What do you think?
Oh, it's going towards these kind of big, skinny, long guys like Wembanyama and Holmgren, which are guys that were just being absolutely punished 20 years ago with the likes of Shaq and Yao Ming and those guys, right?
Like 7-foot point guard sort of?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, they both can handle the ball. They can shoot threes, but they can do a lot of different things. But the game now analytically, so it's so big analytically where, you know, most analytics teams say shoot more threes than the other team and you'll win most games, you know, if you have shooters.
Did you see the Warriors yesterday when they shot?
Yeah.
That's almost a record, I think.
You get on a run and it's just hard to guard. So I don't think that changes too much. Look, does it take someone like another Shaq 2.0 to come in that's 7-foot athletic that you just can't guard? But there's teams out there that are like, we don't care if you score on the post because we're going to come down and get up more threes.
Yeah, right.
So it's tough. I think where this changed, where a lot of people forget, we played Memphis. The year we won the championship, we played Memphis in the conference finals, and they were the last beacon of the big team. So they started Zach Randolph and Marc Gasol, both big lumbering big men, right? And we were kind of the opposite. We had myself in the middle, but then Draymond, a more mobile four-man, and all our guards. That was kind of the last battle of that. And I think I always circle back and think and say to people, if Memphis win that series and beat the run-and-gun style, does it go this heavy to run-and-gun? Because then maybe teams say, shit, we're going to load up with a lumbering 4 and 5.
Yeah. When the Warriors win, they're all like, we have to be like the Warriors or beat the Warriors. And
it's a copycat league. It's much like AFL. Like whoever wins the last premiership or championship,
everyone copies.
Teams look at it and go, oh, shit, we got to do all that. We're going to change our identity to copy that. And I don't think you need to throw the baby out with the bathwater for a lot of teams. I think that's kind of death, because if you don't have the squad to do that, and that's what a lot of people have figured out, the Warriors style is people have tried to emulate it, but you need the right pieces. You can't just emulate it. Like, you know, you need the right pieces that are okay to give up. Like, you need a big that, like myself, that can come in and say, I'm going to give up touches for the betterment of the team and just do X, Y, Z. Or Andre Iguodala, we're going to start you off the bench. You've been a career starter. You were an all-star. Come off the bench for us. Like, that's not easy to tell a lot of NBA players to do that with the man on their team, right? So not as easy. It's easier said than done, but I always circle back to that Memphis Golden State, because that was the last – Memphis was probably the last beacon of a big lineup that was big, slow, grind-down basketball.
I've got to ask this question around the greatest of all time debate. You would have grown up watching the Bulls. I know Tony Kukoc was one of your heroes.
My life heroes, too.
And you played against – so he played with Michael Jordan.
I got to play with him, too.
You did?
A lot of people forget. Yeah,
Tony,
my rookie year was his last year. So it was like full circle, man.
Wow.
It was like a guy, I had his jersey as a young fella, as a 12-year-old. I get to Milwaukee, and they knew I idolized him, obviously, so they're like, come back another year and try to be a veteran for Bogut. And it was pretty cool. He was pretty cooked by that time, like mentally and physically. He was that grumpy old man. Like,
he's Croatian, and your heritage is Croatian, correct?
We spoke Croatian on the plane and stuff. Oh, cool. So it was just really cool. Like, it was full circle. But
so watching Michael Jordan, and you would have played against LeBron for 14 years of your career, and you're a Clevelander at the same time.
Oh, yeah, for 48 hours.
So who's better, or who has the better resume? There's different angles to the conversation. Your thoughts?
My bias is like Jordan, because I grew up in the 90s and that was my childhood. It's sentimental. Like, it's the Gatorade commercials, the Up and Under Like Mike, Be Like Mike song. You know, if you remember that. So I'm biased in that. LeBron's a fantastic basketball player. I think LeBron is probably a better all-round player offensively as far as assists, rebounds, but Jordan, as far as killer instinct, closer, game
big,
winner.
Big game, yeah.
I think, the guy's shoes are still the best selling shoes today. So I think that tells you.
It's a full business in its own.
But it just tells you how he's an iconic brand. And he was probably in a great time in the marketing journey of the world and being able to open borders and get your message everywhere. He was in that when it was a scene. I go Jordan. Just based on that, I just love the way he played. And LeBron's still, you know, going to go down as one of the greatest all time. And Kobe's in there as well, in my opinion.
Back on the AFL, you're an Essendon man. Have you ever been and addressed and spoken to clubs, given the fact that you were in this professional era of probably the most professional sport in the world? Have you ever gone and spoken to a club?
I have to Essendon a few times. Right. This would have been 10 odd years ago, and I was still at Windy Hill. Yeah. And that was pretty cool to see. So... but recently, no. I think I don't think I'll be on anyone's hot list to call.
Why?
Because I'm pretty.
Because your political views and all that.
Oh, definitely that. Yeah, I mean,
I wouldn't worry about that. I mean, I don't judge someone on their political views. I look at your views and I go, either I agree or I disagree.
And I'm the same. I think that's where we are in society, though. People will base their view on you upon a tweet or a media grab, but you're one of the few that's level-headed, mate. There's not a lot out there.
Yeah.
And that's both sides, right?
Yeah.
There's not a lot out there that are like that. It's very, and really...
I look at the guy over in Peter Malinauskas, the Premier over in South Australia at the moment. I go, well, he's probably the opposite to what I probably vote for, but I would love for him to be back here operating this state right now, because because he would make a difference.
it's not a high bar here.
It's the thing with politics. Unfortunately, you skip to conclusions and it can be so divisive. Just because one person has an opposing view doesn't mean you can get along and come to, you know, positive solutions.
The agree to disagree, the art of that is gone in today's era.
It's either black or white.
It doesn't have to be. We can have
nuance.
A part of going from a child to an adult is been able to agree to disagree with people and have conversations. And I've taken things from people that I might not have agreed with before a conversation and be like, shit, that was a good point. I'm going to research that. You know what I mean? And that's part of growing as a person.
But
I think as soon as you stymie or try to silence one side or the other, I think it's just a losing proposition.
Your favourite sport other than basketball would be?
I don't think it's classified as a sport, but poker. I mean, yeah, it is. It is classified as a sport, actually. But
would you like to go and play in the World Poker Championship?
I'll go over there eventually, yeah. Yeah, I play a fair bit of poker. Oh, okay. I really enjoy it. Big fan of it. I think it's a great game, especially post-career for me. It's not taxing on the body.
It's fantastic.
Sit in a chair, you can get someone to make a coffee or a tea, and you got your cards. And
is there a real skill to that, do you think?
Oh, man, it's insane, yeah. A lot of it's practice as well, is just being put in spots and figuring out different spots and betting patterns and why did he bet that if he didn't bet it Texas Hold'em. He didn't bet it when the three cards were out, he didn't bet it, but now he's trapping me. It was that whole it's chess. It's mental warfare. Then you get little rivalries on the table. Sometimes some guy just keeps getting you and you get another guy. And then there's a bit of argy-bargy and shit-talking. And then, I just love the whole premise of it.
Have you always wanted to be able to count cards? Are you that smart that you can and memory is good or not?
Not like high-end, like blackjack, figuring out a shoot or whatever. But I don't think it's that complicated if you get someone to teach it to you. But, yeah, I mean, you somewhat got to count cards in poker. You know, obviously 52 cards, so you can kind of figure out how many outs you've got. You got to kind of know, I've got this many outs if I call for a card that's going to favor
chance.
Me. But I think it's just the mental warfare of it. And I think transitioning from basketball, I had a void of competitiveness, and that's why COVID was so hard. And we ended up playing a lot online because when COVID hit my poker group in the US – that I played with, which all in Silicon Valley, funnily enough, which ended up being a network to my off-court business stuff, which all just kind of, came into one. But they brought the game online so I could play from Australia. So it helped me to get into some competitive environment from basketball.
Just one last question. Can I have one more?
Yeah, you can have as many questions as you want.
You play this incredible professional sport. You're incredibly good at it. We spoke about the money and the waste of money with some basketballers, and some are okay and some aren't, or most aren't. Are you good now? Have you set up the rest of your life with what you've been able to do in basketball?
Yeah, 100%, yeah. Right. Like, I don't have to work another day in my life.
Fantastic.
And my kids most likely won't have to neither. So I have a lot of different hats that I wear.
Good on you. Yeah.
Whether it be here in Australia. Like just mentioning the poker game, because of my love for poker, I ended up in a game with all the probably most powerful Silicon Valley investors and VCs, venture capitalists in the world, and network with them to get into deals with them and different kinds of things. So I enjoyed that space. I take pitch meetings to people that have startups and whatnot, especially here in Australia. And I enjoy sitting with people and hearing their passion for what they've built and what they've changed. And some I invest in, some I don't. Real estate, all the usual investments. But I'm in a pretty good position to, live a pretty comfortable life.
But it's good that
that's pretty refreshing to hear.
Not putting your feet up, keeping busy, got to stay motivated and stay engaged for sure. I also hear that you're a bit of a car nuffy.
Yeah.
You've got a beautiful car collection. What have you got? What does it look like? Brian's a bit of a hothead himself.
You'd be a what do they call the
muscle cars?
Muscle car, man.
Yeah, muscle car.
351 GT or something.
Yeah, I've got a good mix. I'm actually both a Ford and Holden man, so sacrilege to most people, but I think each different eras, I like different eras, so I like 60s and 70s Fords, Mustangs and Australian GTs.
I'm a car man. I'm a tappet head. I'm all those things, but I can't stand the muscle cars of that era.
Really?
The 351s and Mustangs. And I worked with a guy when I was doing my plumbing apprenticeship that raced Mustangs, and he had Peter Gagan's famous old Mustang that he raced. And even that sitting there staring me in the face and working on it didn't really stimulate me.
So what's your era then? What's your era?
Era of cars is probably modern. I'm liking what I'm seeing with Adam McLaren and all those sort of top-end cars.
Okay, high-end sports
modern,
car. Okay, yeah.
Modern cars.
Yeah. I mean, my whole thing was my father was a mechanic. He was a carburetor and fuel injection specialist.
Right.
So I grew up in whenever school holidays or whenever I wasn't at school, I was at my dad's little workshop. He put a little hoop up there for me, and I'd see all these cars rolling in. And I've got a collection of Brock Commodores, all those kind of cars, and I'd see him be like, "Whoa, like this is super nice, loud." Always an in your face color.
Yeah,
nice.
So coming to money. That's how most car collectors' journeys start. Is
so. So what do you do with them? You sit them in a factory.
I'm at a crossroad. Yeah, I'm kind of. One thing you learn about cars is the longer they sit, the worse they get. You got to drive them because some of them just sit for so long before we actually take them out for a long drive.
Fuel, batteries.
It's mainly the seals and the rubber seals because they get dry,
they
corrode, and then as soon as you start getting movement through them, they just crack.
See, that's why I tell you the generator on our solar system comes on once a week.
Yeah,
is to lubricate.
I get them started, but like I said, you still got to drive the things. And I'm at a point now where I'm going to severely downsize my collection. I'm at about 20 at the moment.
Right.
And I'm at a point where I'm going to probably cull that into about 10, and then reassess and see where I'm at. But it's hard. It's at a point where I've got to hire a full time mechanic pretty much to go through them on a daily basis or a weekly basis. And it takes the joy away from them. And now that I've got two young kids and sports starting and school and this and that, I just don't have enough time to drive them. But I've got some absolute crackers. Like I've got a VL Walkinshaw all original with like 7,500 kilometers on it from brand new. I bought before the peak, luckily, and I've just been hanging on to them. I've got an original Blue Mini Brock VK Commodore. So a good mix of stuff that has gone up really well. And I just by accident, that passion.
Is it an investment or is it more
become an investment. Yeah. I bought before all the rage. So I bought in like mid, I think it was like two, I was started collecting from about 2008 to about 2016. I bought most of my collection. And then with COVID and everything that happened, it just gone through the roof. So, just by accident, the portfolio has done pretty well.
I remember growing up, so we've always, Brian and Tanya live in Lawn, and we used to spend holidays down there and school holidays and stuff. I remember being in Lawn several times and would see this giant man in a hoodie in the middle of winter walking down the street. What was your connection with Lawn?
That was me, was it?
Yeah.
I think I've only been there once.
Right. Wow. A couple of times. My memory is failing me then.
Yeah, no connection to Lawn. I think we're just here in the off season. I think my mate was going down there for a weekend and I took the girlfriend at the time and we just went up there for a weekend. Probably the wrong season. I remember it was freezing. I was like, oh my God, it's windy and cold. But I always like to go out different parts of Australia. That's one thing I do now is we try to take the kids to different experiences. And that's the one thing with money is like, all the cars, houses, all that stuff's great, like material things. But one thing that I've learned with having money is the experiences you can provide for your family and friends, and that's what I cherish more than the I got a nice watch or a car. It's like, okay, great. Who gives a shit? In my opinion, and that to most people watching this, I'll be like, I'd love to have all that, but it's the experiences. Once you give them the money, you can go and fly here and see different things and get some behind the scenes access to things if you pay a bit more money. That's what I love doing, and that's why you would have saw me in Lawn. I just like to explore different parts of Australia, and it's still my dream to one day. Don't know how I'm going to do it because I can't fit in a caravan, and it might be the RV route. But I'd love
that. They don't make beds for 7 footers
in caravans.
That's
exactly where I'm at the moment. The RV route. I'm thinking RV. Am I thinking caravan? I'm certainly not thinking tent.
Yeah, I'm not doing tent. I need a nice mattress.
But like in America, the RVs they're a dime a dozen, and you can go and buy something beautiful or $300,000.
I've looked at the big boys, like the big tour bus ones. Yeah, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it properly.
That's me as well. But to buy one of those in Australia is nearly impossible.
I've looked at them. I've looked at them already. The ones so I was looking at. You're looking at half a mil to a mil for the big boys, the tour bus types, but. Post, kids growing up, I'd love to jump in one and just go around Australia along the whole coast.
We're leaving soon.
Yeah, really?
Haven't told you, but we're leaving soon. Well, Andrew, it is bloody fantastic that you've given us your time. Appreciate it. Good luck for the future. Thanks.
No worries. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
So thank you very much, everyone. And don't forget Lawson Lodge Country Estate. It's an absolute ripper. You've got a wedding, a special occasion, 40th or 50th, a conference, you name it. Get up to Lawson Lodge. It's in the Macedon Ranges. It's actually at the base of the foothills up there. It's a ripper. Got an amazing accommodation set up there with executive suites and cabins. An incredible private golf course. My favourite, the incredible bar. An indoor part is absolutely unbelievable. This is all privately owned by a family. It's an absolute ripper.
Yeah, beautiful. So if you are interested, you can head to their website and contact Chrissy to receive a special offer. With that special offer, you obviously mentioned that Life of Brian sent you. So yeah, please, if you are interested, go to Lawson Lodge Country Estate.
It's a beauty.
Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Bye.